Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. U.S. President Donald Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping reiterated their mutual commitment to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula during a telephone conversation Friday. Mr. Trump responded as Pyongyang leveled accusations that the U.S. leader was driving the Korean Peninsula to the brink of nuclear war.
We want to talk about a country that has misbehaved for many, many years, decades, actually, through numerous administrations, and they didn't want to take on the issue, and I have no choice but to take it on, and I'm taking it on, and we'll either be very, very successful quickly, or we're going to be very, very successful in a different way quickly.
And he repeated his earlier warnings to North Korea against threats or actions toward the island of Guam. Ahead of a planned visit to the U.S. by Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, President Trump has indicated how the U.S. could respond to what he calls a dangerous mess there.
Thursday evening, Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro said he wanted to meet U.S. President Donald Trump. You can hear Maduro instructing his foreign minister to set up the meeting, preferably when he visits New York in a few weeks. However, on Friday, Trump indicated a military option against Venezuela is on the table, describing the situation there as a dangerous mess.
I'm not going to rule out a military option. We have many options for Venezuela.
Venezuela is facing mounting international criticism over Maduro's crackdown on opponents and moves to consolidate power, including the selection of the all-powerful Constituent Assembly. Steve Miller, VOA News.
Find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Both celebrations and angry protests erupted in Kenya after incumbent President Uhuru Kenyatta was declared the winner in presidential elections. Riots broke out late Friday in strongholds of opposition candidate Raila Odinga. A regional police commander told the Associated Press Saturday that police shot and killed two people during riots on the outskirts of a city where Odinga has strong support. U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said Friday that the U.S. diplomats in Cuba who have suffered hearing loss are apparently the victims of health attacks. Canada revealed Thursday that at least one of its diplomats in Cuba has also been treated for hearing loss. It was not immediately clear how many U.S. diplomats have been affected by these attacks. Tillerson said the United States holds the Cuban authorities responsible for finding out who is carrying out these attacks, not just on our diplomats, he says. As you've seen, there are cases with other diplomats as well. State media and the United Arab Emirates say four UAE soldiers have been killed in a helicopter crash in Yemen. WAM News Agency reported early Saturday that the soldiers were participating in a Saudi-led campaign targeting Shiite rebels and Yemen. WAM said the helicopter crash happened in Yemen's southern Shabwa province, where U.S. airstrikes have targeted Yemen's local al-Qaeda branch. The Saudi-led coalition is fighting the Iranian-backed Houthi rebels, both from the air and the ground. The rebels seized Sana'a in 2015, forcing the internationally recognized Yemeni government into exile to Saudi Arabia before a return to the Yemeni port. UN officials say recently 80% of Yemen's population is in desperate need of food, clean water, and medical care. A cholera outbreak has killed more than 1,700 people since April, with more than 320,000 suspected cases. Canada's government has partially filled in a ditch so that pedestrians surging through an illegal border crossing from upstate New York into Quebec won't hurt themselves. It has set up processing tents and is hiring people to transport and feed the newcomers. Despite those welcoming gestures, Haitian asylum seekers cannot get too comfortable, according to some immigration sources. Many Haitians would find it difficult to qualify as a refugee in Canada and claim political asylum, as one told VOA. Canadian immigration law requires that claimants prove a well-founded fear of persecution because of race, religion, or political or sexual orientation. However, economic hardship is not enough. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Reaction has been mixed and varied. Parts of Central Province are jubilating, and parts of Western Province, I think people have been demonstrating, and parts of Nairobi demonstrating about the results.
African leaders congratulate Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta for winning a second term.
We did not have any details of the meeting apart from the statement that was made public that both met and committed to continue working towards long-lasting peace.
Mozambican President Filipe Nyusi meets long-time opposition leader Afonso Dhlakama.
The key factor that the president has led major reform initiatives and attracted some very sustainable foreign direct investment that has now the positive impact on the economy are specifically the agro-industrial sector.
And the government of Gabon implement strategic measures to diversify the economy. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. African leaders are congratulating Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta on his re-election for a second term in office. Tanzanian President John Magufuli, Rwandan President Paul Kagame, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni, and Zambian President Edgar Lungu congratulated Kenyatta following an election described by both local and international observers as free, fair, transparent, and credible. Kenyatta won the presidential vote with 54.27%, defeating Raila Odinga, leader of the main opposition NASA coalition, who garnered 44% of the total vote cast. But the opposition insists the presidential poll was rigged. For reaction about the outcome of the vote, I reached James Mwamu, a Kenyan lawyer and political analyst in the capital, Nairobi.
The reaction has been mixed and varied. Parts of Central Province are jubilating, and parts of Western Province, I think people have been demonstrating, and parts of Nairobi demonstrating about the results. Last night, there were demonstrations, and the police has used excessive force. There have been casualties, and people have been taken to hospitals. Demonstrations are still going on up to now, and we do not know for how long. Part of the problem, I think, is because after the announcement of the presidential results, there has not been any communication from the NASA leaders.
The NASA team angrily walked off. Prior to that, they said the election results appear to have been tampered with. They said the computer network of the IEBC was tampered with. That was rejected. They are yet to officially concede. Could that have been a reason behind the displeasure that their supporters are expressing today?
Yeah, I think that is partly one of the reasons why the supporters are expressing a dissatisfaction with the results. I also think that perhaps the IEBC should have given this thing another one day, look at those claims and the allegations that the NASA coalition had made, because they have 7 days, which means that after the elections, they had up to Tuesday, according to the law, to announce those elections. So I probably did not see the reason why there was a hurry to again announce these elections at night. What also is raising suspicion is that by the time they were announcing the elections, the Jubilee government had already set a stage to celebrate Uhuru's win. It's as if they were expecting the announcement to be made yesterday. The Chebukati team has handled the elections very well up to the point of the announcement and reconciliation of the result.
The NASA, yes, or the main opposition party coalition, has a legal recourse. Do you expect them to take that route?
They have said it time and again that the court option is not an option open to them. And that also leads me to the question what they really intend to do. I think they are partly trying to say that they perhaps do not have faith in the Supreme Court. But I think that if they have a genuine cause despite their misgivings about the Supreme Court, it will be important for them to file those documents before the Supreme Court of the Republic of Kenya for the court to look at it and find out if the elections that were carried out were credible, verifiable, and transparent. Because that's what the Constitution says. The elections must be verifiable, must be transparent, and must be accountable.
During his acceptance speech, President Uhuru Kenyatta called on Raila Odinga, saying he's still his brother and that the election is over. They must move on, unite the country, and to maintain peace and stability. Do you foresee Raila Odinga, the former prime minister, making the gesture and continuing to ensure the country remains peaceful?
It was laudable for the president to have said what he did. But you see, the problem we have had in this country is that sometimes that is said on the podium of the elections, then after that, the action that follows is not in tandem with what has been said. So that I would definitely find, right, because you see, Raila was in a coalition. So before he even extends that gesture to Uhuru Kenyatta, I think he may have to consult his coalition partners whether they agree on the way forward.
James Mwamu is a Kenyan lawyer and political analyst. He spoke with me from Nairobi. The Mozambican president Filipe Nyusi and the leader of the main opposition party RENAMO, Afonso Dhlakama, have renewed talks on ending hostilities. After their meeting, the two leaders released a joint statement saying they focused on the next steps needed for the peace process. They also vowed to continue with a peace dialogue geared towards ending hostilities by the end of the year. Eduardo Nomburetti, the head of the opposition RENAMO's external relations, told me the dialogue between the two leaders is good news for all Mozambicans, irrespective of their political affiliation.
Well, as you said, we did not have any details of the meeting apart from the statement that was made public that both met and committed to continue working towards a long-lasting peace, and that the dialogue will be the way to achieve that long-lasting peace. This is what we all know. This is what was made public out of that meeting. And of course, for all of us, all the Mozambican, that represents a true hope for a true peace in this country. And we can say that both leaders are truly committed to achieve peace through dialogue.
What would you say has been the reaction of Mozambicans following the statement that demonstrated commitment from both sides to work towards achieving a long-lasting peace in Mozambique?
Well, we see a lot of joy and happiness, all the comments from across the divide. People are happy, people are expectant, and there's a confidence that this meeting really represents the new beginning in the way the peace negotiation is going.
Do you foresee both men having another round of meeting in an effort to create a long-lasting peace in Mozambique?
Yes, in their statement they said they shall meet soon and that the whole process should be concluded by the end of this year. So I believe before the end of the year there will be a meeting or a series of meetings so that the desired outcomes be achieved by the end of the year.
As a prominent member of the opposition party, from what you have seen so far about the demonstration of political will from President Nyusi, what does that mean to the opposition RENAMO?
Well, we are very hopeful because both leaders are working together to achieve that peace. It's not only a willingness from one side, it's a willingness from both sides. Both sides are committed to work together. And this gives us not only as the opposition, but all of the Mozambicans, all of the Mozambicans that we may achieve the peace sooner than many can expect.
Well, as you said, this appears to be a breath of fresh air in Mozambique. What does this mean to the people of Mozambique?
Well, this is very significant because, as you know, without peace, we cannot built our hopes. We cannot work towards a greater development of our own country. But with peace, the door is open. The windows are open for all the Mozambicans to have their dreams, to have their wishes. With peace, we can achieve so much. And this is what we're all praying for, that this new wave of hope will come to realize all the wishes of the Mozambicans.
What is the message from RENAMO following the willingness that Amfoso Dhlakama, your leader, has shown in meeting with President Nyusi?
Well, the message of RENAMO is the same, that peace is the only way that should be followed. I mean, dialogue and negotiation is the only way that should be followed to achieve peace. That for the countries to continue its development path, we need to achieve peace. And this is not for one or another party, it's for all Mozambicans. And the message of RENAMO is that we should all focus on achieving a long-lasting peace through negotiation, through dialogue.
Eduardo Namboreti is the head of the Mozambican opposition RENAMO's external relations. He spoke with me from the capital, Maputo. The government of Gabon says it is implementing measures to diversify the economy. The aim, officials say, is to wean the country off the over-reliance on petroleum, which has been the mainstay of the economy. Recent global oil prices have affected the country's economy, prompting opposition and civil society groups to say the government's plans have failed to improve the living conditions of Gabonese. They said despite repeated promises, the administration has failed to deliver. For reaction, I reach Liban Suleiman, coordinator for Gabon's Vision 2020.
I believe that the key sectors that the president has led major reform initiatives and attracted some very sustainable foreign direct investments that has now the positive impact on the economy are specifically the agro-industrial sector, where we have reached a certain level of growth and with some major projects. We're talking about more than $1.5 billion of investments and the execution of a growth of 140% in the employment in the sector. The other sector, which has actually brought significant growth and countered the effects of this drop in commodity prices in oil, is naturally the mining sector, where today Gabon has a very strong manganese exportation model, imposed a certain level of transformation of the manganese production. And today we have one of the most advanced transformation units that produces silico manganese north of Mwanda in the Otogwe province.
Some critics of the government are saying that despite all these lofty ideas and programs and measures the government has implemented, the people in Gabon, Gabonese, are not feeling the impact of it and that their living conditions have not improved. What do you say to that?
I think that this is a process that is continuous, and such an effort of transformation of an economy based on extractive industries into a productive economy will always have its consequences and the time that the reforms need for there to be results. Nevertheless, I would say that the first biggest issue that we have in Gabon is naturally what the continent is facing in general, and particularly the sub-region, the drop in the prices of oil. Oil stays naturally the key driver of our economic model and growth and our public expense model. Nevertheless, you have to recognize also some major achievements on the social indicators. Latest statistics have shown that Gabon is actually one of the countries where the development and the Millennium Goals have been the fastest to be implemented. There are some issues. There are some stagnations in certain sectors. Oil sector, there has been a loss of a lot of jobs, and this is to be recognized. And as well as we have to recognize that in the infrastructure sector, there has been a loss of jobs based on the government having to slow down certain major infrastructure programs that have been run from 2010 to 2014. But the sectors of agriculture, the impact is clearly visible. We're talking about 180% creation of new jobs. We're talking about the same thing for the sector in mining, where with 30,000 new employments that have been created in this specific sector. And beyond these sectors in the wood sector, there are more than a multiplication of 2.4 of the number of units of production. So So in the industrialization process of Gabon, the results are starting to be seen. And eventually, as these industries are maturing, they will arrive.
What should the people of Gabon expect from all these measures and plans and programs that the president is leading or implementing at the moment in terms of improving their living conditions in the country?
I believe that transformation is a process. And any process has its ups and downs. And obviously, what we need is conviction, and that every single person contributes to the productivities that are necessary in a globally competitive world. Independently, I think that the government has the duty of pushing the country from a highly state-driven economy that, as it has been in the past, specifically as with our dependence on oil, to a productive economy. And what the citizens should expect, as the president just launched today, is the transformation of a civil service-based employment mechanism to an industrialized employment mechanism. And this is why the government is highly investing in the constructions of professional training and vocational training centers for our youth. As you know, the population of Gabon is more than 66% less than 30 years old. And this is the population that the government is actually working for. And long-term vision necessitates short-term sacrifices.
Leban Suleiman is the coordinator for Gabon's Vision 2020. He spoke with me from the capital, Libreville. The Cameroonian Information Minister says national security officials have discovered a cache of weapons in Bamenda. Issa Chiroma Bakari says at least 6 people have been arrested as investigations continue. Weapons found include improvised explosive devices and semi-automatic rifles. The suspects, the information minister says, smuggled the weapons into Cameroon with the aim to carry out an attack in Bamenda during the May 20 celebrations. Chiroma told me the investigations would continue, but quickly added that the administration in Yaoundé will not be deterred in its mandate to protect life and property as stipulated in the constitution.
Our police successfully, unfortunately, has conducted an operation of search after having received an information according to which the armed wing of the secessionists, they have collected and hidden a military arsenal in Bangui. The leader has been arrested. All of those who, in one way or other, were either member or accomplice of this operation, all of them have been arrested, and they are right now under investigation in Bamenda. As the case is under investigation, and the ringleader has admitted being the author and the owner of this, I think that it is inappropriate for me to make any kind of comments which will impair the efficiency of the operation which is being led right now by our forces of security.
So how many people have been arrested in conjunction with the ongoing investigation?
In conjunction with the ongoing investigation, I can say that maybe 6 people have been arrested and are being investigated. But what can I assure you that the tunnel was taken in his own house, and we have produced all the photo and the documents which unequivocally testify that, they have been arrested red-handed.
Well, will the process of prosecution of these people be transparent?
Well, it is too early to pronounce. I'm speaking on behalf of the government. The case is under investigation. Any statement that I can say right now may jeopardize, may impair the investigation. The government has to be neutral. Let the inquiry be professionally led by people in charge of it. What we can understand is that, for as long as it is not established beyond all reasonable doubt that they are the one who are the author and abettor of this, nothing can be said. So right now they have their own right, and this is what I can tell you at this point of time.
How are you assuring the people of Cameroon, particularly those in Bamenda and the English-speaking areas, about protecting them, since this is the mandate of the government to protect life and property there, with some of these secessionist groups, as you said, parading and marauding in those areas.
Yes, this is the responsibility of the government, to protect people and their wealth, protect the people and to enable them to enjoy all the rights enshrined in our constitution. The enjoyment of their rights depends on the government. The reason why, and you are right by raising this issue, all measures are already taken and will be taken with regard to the threat that those, the armed wing of the secessionists, threatening people.
Why is the government not negotiating in good faith without preconditions to address some of these concerns to pretty much undermine any possible secessionist group who would want to take up arms against the government and the people of Cameroon?
Nobody can question the bona fide of the government. The government is in good spirit, in good faith. The government on my behalf keep always repeating the same thing. Whatever is authorized by the law, whatever is included in our constitution and the jurisprudence, the enjoyment of such a thing falls within the responsibility of the government. So when our brothers and sisters, they say that they are frustrated, they feel that they are a second zone citizen, it is completely wrong. We say that, okay, if your claims are grounded, are very well founded, take them to the head of state or to whoever is entitled to address them, there is no problem. Through dialogue, there is no problem that cannot be settled through dialogue and people of good faith.
Issa Chiroma Bakari is the Cameroonian Information Minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Yaoundé. By harnessing nanotechnology, researchers are able to quickly turn skin cells into any other cell type without removing those cells from the body. A new report shows how this could save wounded limbs. For VOA, Ben Thompson has details.
Researchers placed small wafers containing some of the latest nanotechnology onto wounds on the legs of mice. A brief jolt of electricity caused them to eject new DNA into the skin cells. That turned the skin cells into blood vessel cells, delivering much-needed blood and nutrients for wound recovery. The mice that received this treatment were much less likely to lose their legs. This technique, called tissue nanotransfection, was reported in the current issue of Nature Nanotechnology. The researchers from Ohio State University also described how they turned skin cells into neurons. The new work follows a number of significant advances in techniques to turn one type of cell into another. Scientists hope this so-called cell reprogramming can one day be used to regenerate damaged tissue or cure conditions such as Parkinson's disease. The particles ejected by the wafers contain DNA fragments that reprogram the cells. They only enter the very top layer of cells, though. So biomolecular engineer L. James Lee, a study co-author, said he was surprised to find reprogrammed cells deep within the tissue.
Within 24 hours of transfection, we actually observe the propagation of the biologic functions deep inside the skin. So we were very surprised in that it actually works for tissue.
Lee said it wasn't yet entirely clear why this was possible. Masato Nakafuku, who studies cell reprogramming at the University of Cincinnati and was not associated with the research, thought the work to create blood vessel cells or endothelial cells was encouraging.
I was very surprised to see very efficient generation of the endothelial cell.
But he added a cautionary note. It is not yet clear that tissue nanotransfection will work on animals as large as humans, since the treatment would have to reprogram cells much deeper in the tissue in order to be effective.
Whether the same technique is applicable clinically in the very near future, that is a bit questionable.
Lee and his team are planning human trials that will demonstrate, or not, the real-world effectiveness of tissue nanotransfection. In theory, the technique should be able to turn any cell in the body into any other cell type. That could make therapeutic applications of cell reprogramming easier and safer because cells would remain in the body during reprogramming. If cells are removed from the body, reprogrammed, and then returned, they could be attacked by the immune system. Ben Thompson, VOA News, Washington.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Say what I'm feeling inside me, I got to let it show. And you know, when they see apa, I know they see nothing. And you know, when they see apa, I know they see person. I want you to dance, go. Yeah.
you to dance, go. Yeah. I want you to move slow, low, low.
We want to run down, now when the sun is done, gone down. But this place nothing like gone down, intention not to paint the town brown. Salad class, the heart we want chill. Anybody gone come for here, them know the drill. Hey, oh yeah, make you cheese. For real.
And that's a jolly, nine matter. And don't do be, oh yeah, ma. So baby, scare, baby, come closer.
I don't bite, cause any question you got, I got the answer.
What you feeling inside you, you got to let me know. Say what I'm feeling inside me, I got to let it show. And you know, Odo Viapa, I know they see nothing. And you know, when I see Apa, I know they see person. I want you to dance, go. Yeah, I want you to dance, go. Yeah, I want you to move slow, low, low.
Asking for more, you don't need any reason. Just follow the beating. This here ain't no prison, so follow my leading.
Inside you, you got to let me know. Say what I'm feeling inside me, I got to let it show. And you know, I know Viapa, I know they see nothing. And you know, when they see Apa, I know they see person.
Oh, I'm making a dance, go.
No matter what you say, for your love I say, baby, oh, baby, you're loving you stay. we say millions now. Oh, hey, I know the easy play. Girl, you the reason I sing this song, yo. Cause I be pressing you automatically, you're my excellence, yo. You are the one, can overcome me.
you see. Baby, dance, dance, baby, shake, shake, yeah. I'm a hot techno. Hallelujah, Hosanna, girl, you I want to. Kill your body, banana, sweet in my heart. When you dance, it's very well. Give me love, it's forever. Want to sing you, the Makosa, oh, yeah. Where your mama do? Where your papa do? Where your sister do?
I feel life on hold. find is in you. All I seek and find is in you.
Cry if I'm to shoot, girl, I'll shoot for you. Ain't gonna kill, baby, just a bullet wound. Prayed about you last night, you came my way. Yeah, I'm a bad liar. If you buy infinity, would you buy for me, oh? When I'm in captivity, would you come for me, oh? Step into the light and let me see your face. See your face.
I am true.
Yeah, cherish you.
Thank you.
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaites, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, crawling on hands and knees has never prevented anyone from walking upright. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has recently contributed $20 million in life-saving humanitarian aid to the Syrian Recovery Trust Fund, or SRTF, to help fund the rehabilitation of Syria. This brings U.S. contributions to the SRTF to a total of $60 million since the SRTF's inception in 2013. $60 million is a significant contribution, but it still represents less than 20% of the $3.3 billion in aid that the U.S. has contributed to Syria since the beginning of the crisis. Since 2011, the Assad regime has committed atrocities against its people, including chemical weapons attacks against unarmed citizens. The ongoing civil war in Syria and the influx of ISIS forces have caused a massive refugee crisis. Refugees from Syria number over 5 million, while internally displaced persons now number over 6.5 million, according to the UN Refugee Agency. The United States is committed to assisting those affected by the terrible war in Syria and the surrounding area. Brett McGurk, Special Presidential Envoy for the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS, recently addressed this crisis.
Our basic goal is to establish the conditions that will allow the local population from the areas freed of ISIS control to restore life to their communities and voluntarily return IDPs to their homes.
Our military actions and our stabilization planning must move in parallel, said Special Envoy McGurk. We have identified 100 critical stabilization sites in and around Raqqa, which will be the immediate focus for demining and restoration. U.S. aid through the SRTF will refurbish medical facilities and provide medical equipment and supplies. It will provide equipment and engineers to rehabilitate and expand electrical grids and water networks, provide food to those in need, and provide equipment and facilities to maintain wheat production for bakeries in Syria. In order to complete our mission of liberation and stabilization in Syria, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said, the international community must remove obstacles to the defeat of ISIS and help provide stability to prevent ISIS from rising anew from the ashes of their failed and fraudulent caliphate.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.